Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
It's so much fun, Nancy. You're just helping me recollect things from my past that have, you know, created were traumatic at times. But I'm just so excited about our next segment. I think I've got some background there that I haven't even shared with you, but I think we'll both find it fun and rewarding.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy, and I've got something very interesting to share with you today about generational business ownership. Today's guest mentor, Jim Kahn, his dad, Claire Kahn, and Walter Wood founded Wood & Kahn. And then Claire's son, which is Jim, and Walter Wood's son, Dave Wood, took over the business for the second generation. And so then the business was handed off or sold to Tim Gilk. This history I'm sharing with you is because with small business, the stories of how companies are founded and passed off from generation to generation gets lost. And so it affects the culture and the depth of history that of productivity that they brought to our cultures. And so in Minnesota, I'm, you know, just want to mine this story a little bit for you as a listener and give Jim Kahn, he's been having a lot of fun, he told me, with resurrecting kind of his own history, 60-year history as an entrepreneur, to weave it together in a way that we can kind of get the pearls of the story and the nuggets fettered out so that you as a listener can kind of tune into what you think is really different elements that you could that would benefit you as a business owner. The other part of this is Jim Kahn's daughter is Lori Healy. And so last week you heard Lori and I talking about wellness in the workplace. So I wanted to bring in Jim right behind her so that we can, I can kind of, you know, build on the momentum. All right. So Claire Kahn, Jim's dad, and Walter Wood, Dave's dad, formed Wood & Kahn in 1947 to sell farm machinery in Minnesota after World War II. Jim and Dave eventually continued their family's history with Kahn & Wood, and Jim wrote this beautiful tribute to Dave in an obituary last year Dave had passed away. I quote, "With great sadness, I acknowledge the death of my friend," so Jim is saying this, "mentor and business partner, David G. Wood, or in our business shorthand at Wood & Kahn, DGW. I was a brash, cocky upstart when I joined the company in 1973 to become a territory manager without a lick of business sense. My father, Claire Kahn, was ready to retire from his Northwest territory encompassing northern Minnesota, Dakota, and up into the sugar beet fields of southern Manitoba. Without resistance, Dave took me under his wing and, without me knowing, so began to mold me into a businessman. And boy, did I take a lot of molding and patience on the part of the molder. But with guidance always delivered with good humor and gentle suggestions to keep me moving in the right direction without breaking too many exceptional relationships that Dave had built and cultivated along the way. He always ran interference for me whenever I was prone to make a mistake. Without rancor and without criticism, building, molding my character in a gentle and caring manner based upon values of high integrity and powerful interpersonal relationships, whom he formed with all that he interacted along the way. DGW, or Dave Wood, was a naval aviator and then a submariner in his early life, and there's quite a story to that episode of his life as well. But I digress. My father, Claire Kahn, and Dave's father, Walter, or Walt Wood, had formed Wood & Kahn in 1947, like I mentioned, to sell farm machinery in Minnesota. Walt died of a sudden heart attack while attending a convention in Idaho in the 1950s. So that was 3 years later. Claire was heartbroken at the loss of his partner, Walt, and asked Dave to come back from the Navy and take over the Wood side of the partnership, of course. Dave did, and started building his own history at Wood & Kahn. When I arrived upon the scene in 1973, Dave had carefully nurtured significant relationships across the country with manufacturers, suppliers, customers, and yes, competitors as well. A soft-spoken, well-mannered, focused human being contained within a vessel of high integrity. One of our favorite relationships was with a company located in Clay Center, Kansas, called Hutchinson Manufacturing Company, and we became their largest distributor in the country of grain augers and grain handling equipment. From time to time, it was necessary to meet with them to plan strategy and continue to build our respective businesses. Dave had a friend in Redwood Falls who had a private high-speed single-engine airplane called Bonanza, which Dave's friend allowed him to fly to our meetings in Clay Center, Kansas. I remember one trip in particular wherein we were actually in the clouds over central Nebraska when a very, very large B-52 bomber appeared in our windscreen for an instant and then vanished, just as it had been, an apparition. And nothing more. It was actually one of the few times that I ever saw Dave really nervous, but he just took an extra long puff on his cigarette and we just motored on to our meeting in Clay Center. Holy cow, what a loss. But it has to happen to all of us. But it's never fun to lose an all-around really, really good guy who brought so many good memories into my life, along with a lifetime of business training and sterling values that served me so well for the rest of my business career when I departed Wood & Kahn in 1985. I never did come to understand what a mentor that David was to me until very recently in my life as he began to suffer the debilitating effects of Parkinson's disease. Why is it that we wait to express our appreciation and love for others when they are no longer able to comprehend the depth of that affection and love? With sadness and great regret for the death, my friend, mentor, and partner, DGW. What a beautiful way to commemorate your friend and mentor and partner.
Nancy, just hearing it again, I obviously wrote it, but it takes me back to the memory of a very wonderful human being.
Yeah. Well, and that's what Tim Gilk had mentioned too, is one of the key things in passing on a business is really trying to carry on a culture that has worked, especially if it works for a company. And Dave built up this company that was really had a great culture. A lot of people respect each other and they really cared about each other and do good work together. And so Tim has been carrying that on.
Unquestionably, the whole values of the company were built on respect for people, employees, suppliers.
Yeah. So I would like to share with the listeners a little bit more. You did a good job of kind of encapsulating your biography of your work. So with a respectful sales personality inherited from his father, Jim Kahn began his professional business career in 1973 as a salesman for Wood & Kahn Company. Educated as a mechanical engineer by the University of Minnesota, Jim arrived on the business scene with abounding enthusiasm, but little business sense. As you noticed in the obituary that I read that Jim wrote. Over the next 40 years, Jim encountered numerous reverses in business that many times took him to his knees, but never broke his spirit. Jim estimates that he has directly hired over 300 individuals during the course of his career. Jim had a knack for identifying gifted youngsters who had the talent to succeed in the mostly technical businesses that he either owned or managed. His greatest pride and accomplishment was not just the hiring of talented individuals, but the hundreds, if not thousands, of years of lifetime employment created for all of those individuals at all those businesses. That's a lot of beautiful history you can take into your heart.
Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah. So, wow. And then you and I have another connection. You're living in Alexandria, and one of my high school friends from Parker's Prairie that I graduated with, one of the editors at the Echo Press in Alexandria, is Al Edenloff. And in 2017, there was an article that was posted or, you know, written about you in the Echo Press when you were 8-year-old. So the heading is Bait Shop Inspires 8-Year-Old. Tell us why that article was put in the paper at that time.
Yeah, well, I have a connection with Al. I know him pretty well. He does a nice job here in Alexandria. And I was reading the paper one day, and it had an article about the Lund's Bait Shop. Well, it just triggered a memory from my childhood. We'd moved out to the west side of Lake Carlos, the wilds, when I was 8 years old. And we were on a gravel road, and we were in the wilderness, at least from my perspective. But I used to ride over to what we called the gangplank. I could buy a soda or a candy bar, and yet we didn't have much money back then. I didn't have an allowance, so I had to create allowance, and I stopped in. I saw a pop sign at Lund's Bait Shop, and I thought, maybe his pop's a little bit cheaper. So I went in,
yeah.
And I said to Norm, I said, Norm, I found out it was the same price, but I said, how do I make some money? Can I help you? Or something like that. And he said, well, I'll give you a nickel for a dozen frogs or, I don't know, 40 angleworms or something like that. Well, we had worms and frogs all over our place at the lake. So I sped back home on my bicycle, dug worms and caught frogs and started making money when I was, it was probably 8 or 9 years old, getting nickels from Norm Lund for pop and candy bars.
That's funny. You're the only person I know that used to catch frogs. outside of, in our family, we did that. We went, when we were young kids around the same age as you, went out and to the swamp and got frogs. Yeah, not, and then, you know, later on you realize, you know, that you killed the frogs, right?
Yeah,
the fun of catching them results in, you know, they all went into these huge tanks, water tanks. And so I was horrified later realizing that the frogs were all going to be killed and used for frog legs or I don't know, whatever. What did they use them for outside of eating?
Well, fishing. Yeah,
they put them on fishing. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, but that's part of the lifestyle that was at that time. And so interesting that you did that. So it sounds like you grew up in a really kind of adventurous home.
I like your word adventure, and you've helped me reflect a lot, Nancy, as I look back on my life. We're going to talk about risk and things like that. But to me, it was never a component of risk. It was always an adventure. And that's the way I approach life. And looking back, you've helped me understand that better.
That's good. And part of the things, entrepreneurs in general seem to, look at the upside of an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And spend a lot less time looking at the downside. And that's part of what catches us is being slapped in the face with a potential negative side. And then, but the upside again there is entrepreneurs are very responsive. So as you will find out, you know, as the listeners will find out, right, as you share more about your upbringing. So what were 5 to 6 words that would describe your parents?
Well, it's kind of interesting. That was one of the most interesting questions that you asked. And I almost had to bifurcate it, and give you 2 answers. My father was a traveling salesman, and he was pretty much gone from home Monday through Friday. And my father had a persona that was a very private persona, and he had a very public persona, and they were both different. His public persona, where he was absent from home And I learned this years later by going into his territory, is that he was one of the most respected salespeople in our whole area selling farm machinery. He was extremely respectful as an individual, sincere, honest, articulate, and a high integrity to a fault. But it was interesting. When he'd come home on weekends, I was free and easy during the week. But the weekends, his relaxation was come home and work around our place at the lake. And so his private persona, when I was around him, was he was introverted. He used a lot of energy in the territory, interacting with people. When he came home, he needed to recover because of that introverted nature. He was pretty controlling. He was very demanding. He was an absolute perfectionist, and he was a very bright, intellectual guy. That was my father. So kind of interesting, two sides of the persona. The only one I knew early on growing up was, of course, the one on the weekends where gave me some pretty good direction, and not often, but once in a while I got a belt when I stepped out of line. Hmm. No injury, no mental injury, some physical injury, but I got over that pretty easily. And you know, just an aside, I probably needed that. If Ritalin had been invented when I was growing up, I probably would have been on it. That's just my high energy level. And
so you feel like you experience attention deficit hyperactivity disorder?
I don't know that. I don't think that, but just a high energy and, not very focused, pretty self-directed, doing what I wanted to do. I should say something about mom. My mother, Monica.
Yeah.
I was the oldest of six, and we moved to the lake when I was 8 years old. And I have five brothers and sisters. And so without dad home, she had to be the key person in our household. She was resourceful, frugal. She's very smart. She was a teacher before she had all of us kids. She was political. She interacted with the local school board. She was a very driven person and very social. But interestingly enough, on her side of the family, there was some mental illness. So this is the other side of the coin with my mother, is that, I made a note. I said she was battered, not battered from a sexual sense, but a mental sense. It came with the genes. And so when she was cooped up in the middle of the winter with six little rugrats and me out of control, she became very battered mentally and became very withdrawn at times. In fact,
so do you mean depressed?
Say again?
Did you mean depressed? Is that what battered
means? Oh, yes.
Means?
Yeah, definitely.
So
yeah,
a depression would kind of settle in.
Yeah, that would be a better word. In fact, my mom got so depressed that there were two points in our lives when I had to go off to boarding school and mom had to go to treatment in the Twin Cities at a place called Glenwood Hills. That was where they used shock treatment to actually run currents through a person's brain. So that was pretty upsetting to our family. But mom had two sides to her both. When she was around and with us and engaged, she was a delightful person to be around, but she had some tough times mentally.
So when she came back from the treatment center after having shock treatment, what was she like and how old were you at that point?
Well, the first time I was in sixth grade, I went to boarding school, Our Lady of the Angels boarding school just north of Little Falls when I was in sixth grade, the last half of sixth grade. And when she came back, she was muted. Her personality had actually gone somewhat flat, but I still saw sparks of her old nature come back. And then a little bit later on timing wise, I'm not too clear on this. Another occurrence popped up, but I don't recollect the timing of it. I knew I was kind of beyond that part of my life and her life, and I may have even been in college by that time.
Okay. It's horrifying how women in particular, in their with mental illness, how harshly women were treated and mm-hmm. not understood absolutely at all. I mean, it's such invasive treatment.
Yeah, right.
And for you to experience that as a young boy, it must have just been really difficult.
There was a huge emotion that came out of it. In a word, just one word, I was homesick. I was extremely homesick for those 4 or 5 months that I was at boarding school.
Wow, that's a long time. How did your dad handle it?
You know, poor dad. You know, he was a breadwinner. He had to farm the other kids out. They weren't able to stay at home, and so you know he had all those balls in the air. And I was upset with him because he would never come and visit me. And of course, I didn't understand why then, but I certainly do now. But he just had a lot of balls up in the air trying to keep everything together.
Yeah, right. And that's such a disruption to the entire home. Jeez, mm-hmm. wow. Okay. Do your siblings, did anybody talk about it? Like later on?
No, not at that time. But there's some, you may be in starting this talk with me now, think there's some residual mental illness. You'll find out as we go forward. But no, some of it did show up in one of my siblings, and unfortunately, it was quite a serious issue. But we've all, I would have to say, been very, very resilient. It goes back to it, with all the issues, you know, that are inherent in families, mine and other people's. We still came from good stock, and so and certainly the values were there. So those were two important things.
It sounds like there was a point where the family kind of, once your mom had her second treatment, did the family then all come back together?
Oh, I think so. It never drove us apart, so to speak. And again, that the first phase was so riveting to me, just because I was in sixth grade, and you know I was taken out of home and put in a boarding school, and it just had tremendous impact on me. But the second time that it occurred to her, I don't have that much clarity to help answer that question, Nancy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's understandable. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's hard, you know, a lot of pieces to put together, and mm-hmm. You don't put them together just all in one sitting, right? It kind of, you've been reflecting on things for a long time, and were you going to say something?
No. I just hindsight brings a tremendous amount of clarity to things you and I are talking about, but I just don't. I know the second incident occurred was my mom, but I don't recall when it was.
Yeah. Well, I know that you experienced with your adventurous spirit and living on a lake, there were lots of fun and enjoyable activities that your family kind of got involved in. Do you want to talk a little bit about what those were?
Well, sure. I can talk about that as much or as little as you'd like me to. As the oldest of six, and again, plunked down in the wilderness on the west side of Lake Carlos, in the 1950s, Mom had her hands full with all the other rugrats, and so there was absolutely no control. I could do whatever I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, except when Dad was home on the weekends. Okay,
the contrast. Yeah, freedom during the week, constrained on the weekend. Yeah. Okay.
No constraints. I remember one time, just a short story. I picked up a map of Douglas County, or county around Alexandria, and I saw a blue stream going from Lake Meltona to Lake Ida to Lake Carlos through several small lakes, and I thought, that sure looks interesting. So I put my little horse and a half Johnson on a 12-foot aluminum boat and headed out for 2, possibly 3 days, and went upstream by myself, camped out overnight. This was when I was about 12 years old. And then had to portage over some trees that had fallen across the stream and went back home. But my point in saying that is that all I had to do, particularly during the summer, I had to buckle down to school, but during the summer, I created my own fun.
Oh, excellent. I guess that kind of explains how you learned about taking risks, is you created your own adventures.
Yeah. And in fact, one more pops to mind. As you mentioned that I had my 12-foot aluminum boat, and one of my neighbors, we had very few neighbors on the lake, but one was Steve Longfellow, who was a descendant of Wadsworth, the poet Longfellow. And Steve had a boat similar to mine. And one of our ways of creating adventures, we'd go out in the middle of the lake, and then we'd back off and then point our boats at each other straight on and go towards each other with the bow of each of our boats pointed at each other to see who would be chicken enough to back off at the last minute, and so we wouldn't actually collide.
Okay, well, that's better than having guns.
Yeah.
Did either. So who was the one who would pull away?
Well, we never totaled the boat, but boy, we sure came close.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. What was your kind of method for handling setbacks and kind of dealing with the trauma that you experienced growing up?
I think it was just looking beyond, you know, obviously the story that I told you about my mother is there's a fair amount of trauma, but other than the homesickness, it really, I don't think it had a serious impact on me because I just always looked outward and beyond and was looking for, I keep saying adventure, but that's what my life, what I tried to create in my life. And that probably kept me from introspection and reflecting and looking back.
Yeah. So we've got the story of you for Norm Lund, catching frogs and digging angleworms around 8. What was the next, some of the next entrepreneurial things that you found yourself getting involved in?
Well, you know, probably one of the first ones when I got, I was a little bit older and a little bit stronger, that we had a tractor in our place. We had 13 acres by Lake Carlos, and one of the things Dad sold was farm chemicals at that time. And so he came up with the idea, I'm sure, and I thought it was a good one, that I'd take the tractor, put some pumps and some barrels on it, and go around the lake. And I created a business called Lakeside Spraying. And I had a sign on the tractor that said, "Bothered by mosquitoes? Call Viking 6 2911. And of course, I got a lot of calls and a lot of resort calls. Well, the mixture we used at that time was a combination of DDT, methoxychlor, and malathion. And trust me, it really blew the mosquitoes off of a resort or a lake place. And I had no knowledge. I took a bath in that stuff every day. I didn't wear a mask. And aside, no ill effects whatsoever today, except maybe I'm a little crazy. But other than that, but you know, I look back with some regret now because we didn't know the hazards. And of course, as I was spraying resorts and trees, I was spraying birds and so on. And those are just some of the things that, you know, I do have a regret over that. But I was ignorant at that time.
Yeah. And now you know better. So you move on. What were you rewarded for in becoming known for as you were becoming an early adult?
I wasn't very good in sports. I tried some sports, but it just didn't work out for me. But I found I could compete in the classroom. And I had a wonderful math teacher. And so I engaged in high-level math in high school, current events. And it came out close to the top of my class.
Well, and so that led you to set up a foundation in your 20s, then to acquire your major pre-engineering degree from.
As the oldest of 6, Dad had never gone to college, and he wanted me to go to college in the worst way. In fact, he wanted me to go to Notre Dame, and I didn't want to go that far away from home. I'd miss my drinking buddies. And finally, St. John's came up, blipped up on the screen, and they had a pre-engineering course at St. John's. And so 1960, I headed off to my freshman year at St. John's University and started in pre-engineering.
And you weren't quite able to finish the degree. What happened?
I was more involved or more engaged in having fun than I was in studying. It's a real shame. I was pretty immature. I was very immature at that age. And for me, the adventure side of things was more important. And venture at that time involved going out and drinking beer with buddies and just having a good time. On the verge of being at that time, we called people juvenile delinquents, and I was probably pretty damn close to being a hardcore juvenile delinquent, but never went over the edge, so to speak.
Well, with all that you've experienced and talked about already, I mean, it's in parenting classes, they talk about, you know, two extremes in parenting, with no restrictions, it causes a lot of chaos. And when it's too rigid, it also causes the inability for a person to integrate. Mm-hmm. Their psychological experiences with their emotional response to it. And so, you know, growing up in a chaotic home, this was the way in which you were processing some of it is through acting out.
Yeah.
Okay. So the experience in jail, you ended up enlisting in the United States Air Force after this with a very compelling letter.
Yes, Nancy, I did send that letter to you.
So if I'm referring to documents, Jim had sent me like a lot of different pictures and documents. And so I'll include in the show notes what makes sense for to enlighten our conversation so you can see, you know, what we're talking about.
There was a short story involved with me going in the Air Force, and this shows my sense of responsibility. There was a big storm on Lake Ida. I had a girlfriend on the east side of Lake Ida that her father was a train engineer. His last name was Blaybaum. And he had three cute daughters that ran the resort and their mother, of course. And when he was gone, we'd go over and visit the girls. Well, there was a big storm one night, and the boats were banging up against the rocks. And so a friend of mine and I ran down, and I tripped, stumbled, hurt my ankle, and was out of work. I was working in a automobile shop that summer. And so I didn't have much to do. Some friends of mine and I decided, let's go to South Dakota and buy some fireworks, which we did. On the way back, one of the friends said, let's see if we can buy a beer at every beer joint between South Dakota and Alexandria. And we did. And that worked pretty good until we got to Evansville, and one of the guys that I was with decided he'd steal some beer from the Evansville bar in broad daylight. And of course, that didn't work out too well. The sheriff was called. We got transported to Alexandria. I got put in jail. Mom had to come and sign me out. And of course, this was after my sophomore year at St. John's, and I'm thinking, I'm not really mentally prepared to go back to school. My parents are disgusted with me. Their investment in the school to help pay for my tuition is being wasted. I'm going to see if I can get in the Air Force. Well, if you have something on your record, the Air Force or the military usually doesn't want to take you. And I was going to have to go to court. Anyway, I talked to the Air Force recruiter, who I talked to a couple months earlier while I was at St. John's, and told him about it. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll call the judge, make sure you don't have to go to court and get that on your record if you agree to sign up and go in the Air Force. And that's what I did.
And then you ended up flying, learning how to fly.
I wasn't a pilot in the Air Force, but I worked on a very technical missile system that was carried by the B-52, and our squadron had two flying slots, and I got one of those flying slots, and so I got to fly. It was like an adventure that you couldn't believe, to be going on a war machine like that that's still in service in our country. And it was just it was absolutely fascinating to me that I was had the opportunity to be part of a group that I was allowed and able to fly in a B-52 bomber for many, many missions.
You continued your service, and how did the trajectory of your life kind of start taking shape?
There was a pivotal event. I've told you about how goofy I was and some of the things that happened to me growing up. As soon as I got in the Air Force, I got pretty serious. I all of a sudden realized, you know, you've got a life to put together here. And the discipline is probably the first time in my life that I'd really been exposed to serious discipline other than the weekends when Dad was home. And I took it to heart. Well, I'd had 2 years of college in a technical field, and the Air Force had a program called Airman's Education and Commissioning Program, AECP. I applied for the AECP, and I was accepted. And it was unbelievable. I had gotten orders to go to the University of Arizona and get a degree in astronautical engineering, and had agreed to become an officer, Air Force officer, for 44 years after I graduated. And I was on my way, and it then was withdrawn because my eyesight was so bad. My eyesight was so bad I couldn't be qualified to be an Air Force officer, even though I could work on bombers where I needed good eyesight to handle electronic things. But that was a real hit. That was a real gut punch for me.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I really didn't dwell on it. I turned around and said, okay, you're going to have to make the best of what you've done. And I did. I moved ahead and I started growing up in the Air Force, and was there for 4 years, and am so thankful. I can't tell you how many times I've told people that I grew up in the Air Force. It was just one of the best experiences of my life.
That's really good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way you turned your life around is really incredible. I bet your parents too were like really relieved that you found something that was working for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And where did you meet your wife, Anita?
Well, we used to, my hometown, Alexandria, always had quite a draw for me. After I'd gotten out of the Air Force, I went to the University of Minnesota and took 3 years to finish my degree in mechanical engineering. I came home one weekend, like we did, to meet some of my old buddies and friends. And yeah, one of our mutual friends, my wife, Anita, and myself, was having a after wedding party in the basement in a home in town here. And I went down in that basement and I looked around for all the pretty girls, because I was single, and my eyes really caught this one. And it turned out her name was Anita. And she was a nurse at that time.
Had what just was her graduated. Last name?
Oh, Anita Nelson.
Okay.
Yeah. And Anita had a new Cougar, 67 Cougar, and had a mortgage on it. I was always frugal, so I didn't believe in that stuff. But anyway, she attracted me in spite of that. And we started dating while I was going to the university. And she actually put me through the last, we got married in my last year of school in 68. And she put me through the last year of school, and my GI Bill had run out. And then one day I saw a posting on the bulletin board. You know, I was thinking about a job. It was a real cold winter day, just like some of those cold winter days we'd had here a few days ago. And it was for a program in Hawaii. So I half kiddingly called her up. It was a Navy program, and said, hey, do you think I should apply for that job? Because I'd been applying for other jobs with Boeing and Alcoa and some others. And at that point in time, there were 10 job openings for every graduate engineer. So I could pretty much have the pick of jobs that I wanted. Anyway, I applied for the job in Hawaii and got accepted. And Anita and I, after our first year of marriage and my graduation from school, moved to Hawaii, and I worked for the Navy for 4 years. And my job was I was part of a test team where we would go aboard fast attack nuclear submarines and destroyer class surface ships, check out all the weapons delivery systems, and then go out to sea and fire exercise torpedoes and rockets. So it was kind of a continuation of that adventure from the Air Force. And a very idyllic. Our first child, Lori, was born in Hawaii. She's actually got a Hawaiian middle name. And we just had a delightful, delightful, idyllic 4 years in Hawaii.
And what's Lori's middle name?
Mahealani.
Oh, love that.
it means beautiful shimmering moon.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Okay. That's beautiful. And then what happened in 1973.
Well,
so, why don't you bridge the gap there?
Yeah, I'll bridge the gap. In fact, I have to step back, take a couple steps back. At the university, when I was going for an engineering degree, I was good at it. I was good in science and math, but it wasn't motivating me. And I'd read, every time I'd pick up a magazine or a publication, I'd read about business. And it just seemed so fascinating to me. So my last 2 years to go, I went across the river to the School of Business and went up to the counter and talked to a lady. And I said, "Ma'am, I'd like to transfer to the School of Business." And she said, "Well, you're going to have to spend another year in school." And I said, "Lady, I don't want to spend another year in school. I just want to get out of school." So I wheeled around, walked back across the river, and finished my degree in engineering. But while I was in Hawaii, as much as I enjoyed being around submarines and ships and airplanes and things like that, the business world really just started to niggle, and it seemed like that if I didn't explore that, that I wouldn't be doing the right thing if I didn't. So anyway, my father wanted to retire from the wooden con.
So in high school and growing up, he was a salesman. Let's see that. So 1947, he started Wooden Con. So how old were you at that time? You weren't born yet.
In 47, I was 5 years old.
Okay, 47, you were five. Okay.
I'm an old guy.
Okay, putting the history together here. Okay. All right. And okay, so go ahead with your dad and founding Wooden Con. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know the first thing when I learned that there was an opening in the territory, and it wasn't put to me, "We want you to come here," or anything like that, but we have an opening to take over Clara Khan's territory. Express your interest if you're interested. And so I started in my adult years. I was, or at that time, I was becoming aware of the public persona of my father and how well he was respected in that territory of Wooden Con up north of Fargo and into Canada. And so I said to Anita, I said, "How would you like to move to Fargo, North Dakota?" And I was met with stone cold silence. It didn't go over well, but
because you were living in Hawaii at the time,
right? We were living in Hawaii. But 4 years actually, we were both starting to miss the seasons. We certainly missed family, even though they visited a lot. Her parents and my parents and our friends, we had a lot of visitors, but something beckoned in the business world, and so I said, "I'll do it, I'll take it," and it was. We often talk about leaving Hawaii for Fargo, North Dakota, and the other thing was the schools, and there was some not so nice things going on in the schools, and we didn't want to put Lori in the school system. We would have had to put her in a private school. So we made the decision to move to Fargo, North Dakota.
And then to finish out this part of our conversation, you ended up having some really early entrepreneurial success.
Oh boy, yes, we sure did. And of course, my father gave me a gift. He had pre-written a bunch of orders. I think, I don't know why this number sticks with me, but when I inherited the territory from him, I think he had pre-written orders for spring delivery, $275,000, that number, which was a big number at that point in time. And so, I went in as a pretty cocky, still youngster at that time. I was in my early 30s and started to really see the goodwill that my father had created in the territory and what he had turned over to me. And it was hard to live up to. I because of his reputation and, the things that people appreciated about my dad.
Yeah. How did you create your own reputation?
Nancy, just full speed ahead. I probably to the detriment of my family, I was on the road all the time. I was able to spend quite a few nights at home because we lived there. My father by choice lived in Alexandria and we lived there. So I would get up at 4, 5 in the morning, hook onto equipment was my pickup truck and drive up the Red River Valley delivering equipment. And so my wife, my spouse, Anita, if it hadn't been for her, I don't think I know I didn't do a good job taking care of my family during that era. I was so focused on business and creating a reputation for myself. That's all I could do, is just charge ahead, knowing the legacy that my father had left for me, the reputation that was apparent in that territory. And I just did my level best to interact and
because you took the company from 300,000 or 275 to 4 million.
Yes. And in fact, that was over a 10-year period, and I thought I could do no wrong. I mean, I was just living on top of the world. We had bought a new house. We had lived early on in the Moorhead side, moved over to the Fargo side, bigger house. And I thought there was everything there was to know. I knew about business. I was so good at it, and I was so smart, and the business was growing so rapidly that nothing could go wrong.
Tell us a little bit more about the how you were bringing, then you brought the revenues from 4 million to 8 million?
Yes. We had two branches. We had the Wooden Con branch in Redwood Falls, Minnesota.
Okay.
We had the Wooden Con branch. What I did in Fargo, Moorhead, is I developed a branch which became the equal in revenue to the Redwood Falls branch. So we both, in 1981, had $4 million in sales. $4 million at Redwood Falls and $4 million in the Red River Valley, Fargo-Moorhead area. And I was feeling pretty cocky that,
I had 40 employees then at that time, too.
What I did is I started out as a traveling salesman. I'd go out in the territory, I'd work a territory up, and then I'd hire an outside sales guy. And then I'd go to a new territory and I'd work that territory up and then hire another outside sales guy. And so doing that over a 10-year period, we bought that volume up to 4 million and we had 20 employees at each location. So we had a total of 40 employees selling about $8 million a year of farm equipment.
Wow. And so in our second conversation, we're going to describe how no business has a track where it's 100% growth, every year. There is a sustainability that you had in building up the business for 10 years. And we'll talk about the next part that didn't go exactly as planned.
Okay, Nancy, I'm looking forward to our next talk.
Okay. Thank you so much for being open and for just sharing kind of the depth and doing the work to really clarify your history so well.
Okay.
Yeah, good. All right. And thanks, listeners. Thank you, listener, for tuning in. And thanks, Mike Cabea, our sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. We've been doing this kind of work since 1992, helping small business owners and emerging entrepreneurial leaders with self-leadership mastery, business ownership success, and that leads to life success. We focus on the dual innovation journey of reinventing yourself as you redesign your business. We do this with one-on-one strategic mentoring sessions. We have several types of labs that you can participate in with your other peers. Both our entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab, which you can really get into the crux of how to run your business more effectively and become more competent. We have meaningful conversations that help with developing a culture that will work for you. I do weekly meditation and yoga that you can participate in to evolve yourself as you redesign your business. You can also sponsor this podcast. We're always looking for people to support our programming, build out our programming with us, and I especially love promoting you. You can get involved in all those different areas because when we mentor, you design a better life, a more fulfilling future as an entrepreneurial leader/innovator, as a competent business owner/practitioner, As a mentor slash role model, and as a human being and master of self, every client starts with a desire to shift something, clarify something, overcome challenges, grow profitability. We started with one entrepreneur. We've mentored thousands. We're ready to work with you. When you show up, we're here. So to get started, go to wementor.com. You can also call me at 612-804-8920, or you can reach me through email, nancy@wementor.com. Get ready and take the next step today.